Welcome to the Tennis Worthy podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Chris Bowers, and today we have a top-class legend of the sport. No one, man or woman, has won more Grand Slam titles than our guest today. 24 singles, 19 women's doubles, and 21 mixed doubles, making a grand total of 64 that will probably never be beaten. She is Margaret Court.
If we got to hitting the ball over to 92 times over the net and I missed it, he'd make me go back and start until I got to 100. I think I had a streak in me. If I could beat a girl six love, I would. People believed in me. I always remember Fred Perry said to me, "Margaret, you should never lose a match."
She's a legend, and while her opinion on same-sex marriage has courted controversy, what cannot be in question is that Margaret Court's achievements in the field of play are among the greatest ever. And it's that aspect of her life that we focus on today, the attributes that made her a Hall of Famer. I sat down with Margaret Court in Melbourne. Margaret Court, what do you think it is that makes somebody a Hall of Famer?
Well, I think most champions you see from a very early age, people will see the talent there, and I think the disciplines, the commitment, the focus of wanting to be a champion. I think it's something that comes from when you're little and you want to be the best at what you do. And I think I very much was tennis and track, and I had a choice at the age of 15. But at that time, I was probably closer to my tennis coach, and he saw something in me because I came from a family that had nothing, and there was alcohol in the home, so my escape was to the outdoors and across the road. I would go, we had 24 grass tennis courts, and that coach of mine, I think, was there in a very early age, saw something in me.
You were the youngest of four children. When you look back to the sort of domestic dynamics, can you pinpoint anything that was, yes, I can see why I ended up winning some very tight tennis matches at the highest level?
I had two brothers that were professional cyclists, but my mum and dad never were very sporting at all, and that's what amazes me. And my dad was sort of a good on the dance floor and a good at snooker, and my mum never played sport at all. My sister didn't play sport, but I was very much a tomboy. I had eight boys in the street, and I'd kick the football and play cricket, and I beat them in all. I loved to beat them. Back then, and my maiden name was Smith, and they called me the head of the Smith gang with these eight boys. And I'd swim the Murray. I was just a very good athlete.
Were you competitive in, you know, basic things like wanting to end a family walk first or playing tiddlywinks or whatever you did?
Probably I wanted to beat all the boys in the cricket and the football and the swimming and the whatever we did. And, you know, we played cowboys and Indians. I always wanted to be the cowboy. So I think there was something there back in those early days. And I think, too, perhaps when I was born, my mum nearly died and I nearly died. And I don't know whether that was something, a survival to live, but that was something within you that always been a determination there. Probably not so much the competitiveness, but the determination side to achieve or to do things well.
Do you think that the proximity of the tennis club opposite your house was instrumental in making you a tennis player, or do you think you'd have found your way to tennis anyway?
No, I think that was it, because my family had no money. My first racket was a paling off the fence, and I'd go over and hit up. There was a big sort of wall, a company that's wall was right up next to the tennis courts, and I used to go over there and hit on that. And a friend of the family saw me doing that, and she had this big old wooden racket. It was so heavy I could hardly get my fingers around it. It was so big, the grip. There was no leather on the grip. It was a wooden grip. And it was my pride and joy. I remember putting transfers on it to try and make it look pretty. So that was my my start to it, and I thought my Christmases had come all at once when I was given that racket. But if we hadn't have been across the road from those courts, I doubt very much. That wouldn't have been in front of me there to do that, and that's probably why I played tennis.
So would you, somebody from the world of track and field be interviewing you now instead of me on the basis that you'd have ended up as a top-level runner, given that that was your other sport?
Well, I always loved running and, you know, would win the school sports and run. Even in the middle of my tennis career, I'd won everything. And I remember one year saying the Olympics were coming up in a couple of years, and I thought I wouldn't mind having a go. There was always, with the Olympics coming around, I always thought perhaps I could have been running in there. And I remember here in Melbourne going and training with Herb Elliott, who was at that time and sort of watching. He'd finished, but Pam Kilbourne and different ones who were runners for our nation, I went and trained with them. And I found it a little bit boring compared to tennis. And I did that for quite a while, and I was quite well up there with them. But I then had to go and play a tournament, and I found that I was sort of galloping around the tennis court. My whole stride went out because I was sort of doing the 220 back then. I just found, if I'm still going to play tennis, I don't think I can do both.
At what stage did you decide that tennis was for you?
I had to make the choice at the age of 15. My coach went to Sydney, went to a coach there who was Yvonne Goolagong after me, but he went to her, to him, and he coached Jan Lehane, who was a top player here in Australia also. And my coach asked, would he take me on? Because I had to get out of my hometown. Back then, it was only a population of 15,000 people. He went to him and he said, no, she's too skinny, too scrawny, she'll never make it. So he came down to Melbourne, my coach did, Wally Rutter. He came down to Melbourne and he approached Frank Sedgman. And Frank Sedgman came and watched me playing in a tournament. And
Sedgman was a scout in those days? Or I mean, he'd finished playing, hadn't he?
He was still on the professional circuit.
Okay, right.
And he was back. And there was a man also called Keith Rogers here who used to hit quite a bit with Frank, and he was a coach. And so they came and had a look at me in a tennis match and playing in, I think it was in the schoolgirls. Albury was New South Wales, Wodonga was Victoria. So I could play in the schoolgirls in Victoria, so it was in Melbourne. And I remember Frank saying, and my coach told me, he said, well, she's very skinny, very scrawny, but she has something. She's a good athlete. He said, she needs to go to my gym. Frank owned a gym in Collins Street here in Melbourne, Little Collins Street. That was it. My move was from Albury down here. I came down here and boarded. My sister was in a boarding house, so I boarded with her. And Frank offered me a job. He had a factory, and I would go to work there, and then they allowed me time off to go and train. And I would go in very early in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, to his gym before the men came in. It was a men's gym, and women back in that time didn't pump weights. Stan Nichols was probably one of the greatest trainers. He was before his time.
I was going to ask you about him because, I mean, in a way, every development in women's tennis has flown from what Stan Nichols did with you. But yes. It must have seemed weird at the time to be doing that exercise.
Well, no women pumped weights like that back then.
And so
they used to call me the Aussie Amazon because I was pumping weights, and they'd take photos of me in the gym lifting these heavy weights. But you know, I loved it. And
so there wasn't a feeling of being
I loved that, and I loved the training. And I used to go down to Percy Cerity, who trained Herb Elliott, run on the sand, on the sandhills. Used to run up in the Dandelongs, and we'd go there and Keith Rogers would take us up into the hills and running. And I loved all that. That was easy for me. I loved the freedom, I think, of the outdoors and just the training and the sport. And I think I was just a born athlete like that.
So why, when you had that much enjoyment of the physical, did you end up in tennis?
I enjoyed that more than playing the tennis side of it.
Right.
And
okay.
That was easy. That was easy to me. I think, too, here in Melbourne in those early years, you know, you have four seasons in one day, and in the winter, we didn't have indoor courts. I would train at Grace Park, or we would go to Kooyong when we were allowed to go in there. And then the Hawthorn Football Club was just across from the Grace Park court. So some afternoons I'd go and run with the footballers.
So when you had really long matches, and of course most of your career was played before the tiebreak, did you actually enjoy the long matches because your physicality gave you such an advantage?
Clay particularly, we used to practice here on the Ondakar. If we got to hitting the ball over to 92 times over the net and I missed it, he'd make me go back and start until I got to 100. So I knew I could hit the rally a long time if I needed to. Not that I enjoyed it, because I'd like to finish it off. I think I had a streak in me. If I could beat a girl six love, I would.
There was no thought of give her a game so that she doesn't...
No, and I think one thing I remember used to be said, some people were beaten before you went on because they knew you were so fit. And then people would tell you that. But I think that side of it I enjoyed, and I was very, very fortunate to not have many injuries at all. And I think the weights and the training were a part of that, because here I am, 81, and I don't have any knee problems or hip problems, and yeah, I've been very blessed like that.
In many ways, you were years ahead of your time, not just on the physical training, but when you talk about getting to 100 shots without making a mistake, I mean, that's what the kids do in the tennis academies today.
Yeah, they were. I was very, I don't know, very fortunate to have men who were able to sow their life, and they were like dads to me. I was very blessed, because I didn't have too much of a home life. But they saw this in me, that I was a workhorse, I think. And they had to say, that's enough, because I had to learn to pace myself.
You were a natural left-hander.
I was. I was in school. I was a natural lefty, started playing left. Back then in the convent I went to, they were changing people who wrote left to right.
So you were forced to change which hand you write with.
But I write left, because I missed out by 1 year in having that forced side of it. But the boys in the street said, there's no good women players left-handed. Women don't play left-handed.
So you started playing at the age of 8. At what age did you switch from left-handed to right-handed?
Oh, around that time. I would have been 7 or 8 when I started. It was very early in the 8 or 9, around that.
And you said the racket was very big. You had difficulty holding it.
I was very fortunate then that my mum saved up and they bought me a year later probably. I remember it was a Gussie Morand Oliver racket. It was beautiful.
Was that a junior racket?
It was a junior racket, and I remember getting that, and that was my pride and joy back then.
So you had one racket for, several years?
Oh, well, I think even when we went on tour for many, many years, when we were playing top, we only took 2 or 3 rackets with us. That's all we used for the whole year.
You see, these days, people would say, well, if you're a natural lefty and you're playing with your right, and Nadal is a natural righty who plays with his left...
I probably would have had a better serve if I'd been a lefty.
Really?
Yeah. I think it would have been more natural to me.
Was there any question of you maybe hitting with a two-handed backhand? I know that people didn't in those days, but you had Vivian McGrath in the 30s, you had John Bromwich in the 50s, so there were a few people.
Never even any thought about it. No, didn't, and in many ways I'm glad, because I loved particularly on the grass, the chip coming into net, the slice. You wouldn't have been able to do that with a two-hand.
How old were you when you realised that you were regularly beating girls of the same age who probably hit the same forehands and backhands as you did, but you ended up winning the matches?
Well, you know, I never did a whole lot in the juniors. Jan Lehane won all the juniors here in Australia. She did not drop a match for 3 years. And then Leslie Bowrey, who won two French. She was in that same age. There was a very good group of strong girls. We're all around the same age. It was about five of us. So we're all pushing one another. And I would win, like in Victoria, the school girls, because Jan wasn't. She was in the New South Wales side. I'd win it in things in Country Week. But when we got into age championships, Jan normally won that. And it was always a battle between Jan and myself, or Leslie and myself and Jan. And so it wasn't until probably I was 17 years of age and I won my first Open. And Maria Bueno come down and Christine Truman.
That was the year you won the women's singles, but you lost in the girls' singles final.
I lost in the girls' singles the day before. I was in four events. I lost the girls' singles, and then I went on to beat... I had beat Maria in the quarters, and then I went on to beat Mary Carter, I think it was, back then. She was number one Australian. She was older than us, a very good player, in the semis, and then I had to play Jan in the final. And that was the first time I'd beaten Jan. Yeah.
Were you surprised? I mean, when one thinks back, 17-year-old winning the Australian Championships...
I was shocked.
You were shocked.
But, you know, I looked at it and I thought I had nothing to lose. I loved to serve in volley because when the grass courts in Albury were so bad at the back then, and I used to hit with the men and practice with the men all the time, and I thought if I didn't serve in volley like them, they wouldn't let me play with them. So that's where I was good in the serve and the volley, and I loved that. I loved the net. So I just thought, well, I'm going to play my natural game. I always remember that. And then I won, and they thought I was too young to go overseas then, so they didn't let me, kept me home for another year before I went overseas. They didn't feel I was developed enough.
There are people who say, well, yes, a lot of Margaret Court's major titles were won when not a lot of people went to the Australian Championships. How well populated was the women's singles from 1960 to 66 when you won your seven on the run?
Well, every year people came down from overseas, but our Aussie girls were very good. Jan would beat them in the quarters, so you never saw their names on the trophies. You always saw another name. And you would have Maria come down, you had Darlene Hard. You even in those early years, you had Billie Jean. She was Billie Jean Moffat. Then you had, what's her name? Sussman would come down.
Karen Sussman, yeah.
Maria Corwell. They would come down, but they'd lose in the quarters of the semis. Not many ever got through to the final back in those early years. You had Anne come down. You had Christine
Anne
come
Jones,
down.
Christine,
Maria Bueno
yeah.
come down. People would say that, but their names never got on the trophy.
But no Australian woman had won Wimbledon at that stage.
No, they hadn't. There were a few that had gone through in the Thelma Long, Nancy Bolton, all before us. But they never sent any women teams away. There were always the men teams. And we had some very good women.
I was going to ask you, how much travel was there in those days? Because this was pre-professional era when I guess you could travel only as much as your national association had the funds for.
That's it. Right. And we didn't have the money, so it was up to them to send away. And I think they realised then they had these four or five good girls, it was time for them to go overseas because they were sending the men, because we were very strong in men here, and the Davis Cup. Yeah.
We've talked a lot about your physical strength, the weights you were lifting. What gave you the mental strength to win so many close matches?
I think probably the determination, and people believed in me. I always remember Fred Perry said to me, Margaret, you should never lose a match. I think you're your own worst enemy often. You know, you had to build yourself. We didn't have psychologists. We didn't have trainers going with us. We had to think for ourselves. And when we did go, we had to go for 10 months of the year. There wasn't the money there to come home. We'd be away for a long time overseas. We used to get homesick.
How did you deal with that?
Well, I retired, I think, in the, in the early 60s, 65. I'd won everything. I said, I'm never going back. I went to Perth to live. I had a friend who came from Perth and trained here in Melbourne, and we stayed with a family together. I used to love going to Perth because I was very well known in Melbourne. Nobody knew me in Perth, so I could just be myself. And she was a squash player, but she did play very good tennis, travelled with tennis for a couple of years, and then went into squash. We went into a fashion boutique together for a few years. She went on in it after I met my husband and went back into tennis, but I didn't pick up a tennis racket in 2 years, but I played squash. Squash kept me quite fit. That was my home, was Perth. And yeah.
Was that a need to give tennis a break? Had tennis become too easy with all the titles you were winning?
I don't think it was that. I think it was being away from your nation. You loved your nation. Sort of living out of a suitcase. Back in that time, there was really no money in it. You didn't live in nice hotels and food and, you know, all that. And you had to play every week. I played 3 events nearly every week. I'd play and be in the final on a Sunday, travel on a Monday, and I'd be playing again. And that's all you knew. During tournaments, you didn't get on practice court too much because you're playing too many matches.
But this is the amateur era where there's only nominal prize money. So how did you fund yourself if you were playing this much tennis?
Well, I think in those early years, I withdrew from the Australian team, from going away overseas in the Australian team. There was an entrepreneurial man here who Frank Sedgman knew. He sent me away with a chaperone back in those times and another girl, just a doubles partner or somebody that I played with and was friends with. And so we went on tour that way for a couple of years. And then I learned, I think, in those early years that Maria Bueno and a few were making quite good money under the counter, under the table, and they're getting accommodation and air tickets and some money. So I learned that too. So I learned that was a way then of being able, particularly the last couple of years before Open Tennis came in, was a way of supporting and being able to go away.
The way it sounds, the way you've described your introduction to tennis and the progress you made as a child, there must have been setbacks along the way. Can you pinpoint any setbacks and how you got over them?
Well, I think you always have your disappointments. I mean, we all have disappointments in life. But I think, you know, you're determined in your heart that I can do it, you know. And I, as I said earlier, I had to learn to pace myself. I didn't know when to stop. You needed to have breaks. I think not probably until after I was married and went on tour with my husband, I probably played some of my best tennis ever, because I learned to take breaks, go fishing in the Gulf Stream and in America, and time out and do things. And in those earlier years, you didn't. You were a bit like a robot, just playing tennis, going on and on. And I think that's why I retired for 2 years, never going to pick up a racket. It wasn't until after I met Barry. We were going farming, and I was enjoying Perth and the break, and not realising why I was keeping myself fit. I said, look, let's go for a year, see the life I've led, and then we'll go farming. And that was really our intention. And then Open Tennis came in, but that first year I got back to number 2 in the world. And then we decided, we can perhaps do quite well. And that was after that then that I won the Grand Slam, all 4
yes,
in the 1 year.
The Grand Slam in 1970, I mean, that was a phenomenal achievement. Yet you describe it almost as if, I might play another year. Was it a sort of casual as you make it sound, or do you think there was actually a secret determination in you to do it, but you just didn't admit it to yourself?
I think other people planted the seed. Somebody had said you won three out of the 4 2 times before that. Why don't you go for the Grand Slam? And I think it was in 1970 that somehow that year, and I was with Billie Jean, I played in the Wimbledon final, and I'd torn the ankle in the quarterfinals and pulled out the mixed and the doubles. And there was a medical friend said, look, if we put an injection in that, ankle, it will last 2.5 hours. Goes any longer, that's going to wear off. I'd never had any injection or anything like that before. Normally, I would have, something like that happened, pulled out. But somehow I had a feeling that was my year to win the Grand Slam. I don't know. I always remember that.
But that was a long final at Wimbledon. You played about 40 games, you and Billie Jean, in 1970.
What, 11, 9, 14, 12, something like that.
I mean, when you look at the footage of it, you looked exhausted, and yet you were probably at the peak of your fitness. Or was the injection wearing off by the end?
I think it's a lot of the mental strain, but I knew if it went to a third set, I'd lose it, because it went for 2.5 hours.
And was the ankle hurting by the end?
Well, by the end of it, you knew, you looked at the clock and it's 2.5 hours, and you know, hey, you've got to win it, because you couldn't go to a third set.
So you were clock watching?
Well, you knew that, and that's what he said, and so you knew that,
Does that add extra satisfaction to what was an incredibly close match against your clear rival at the top of the game at that time?
I think so, because I knew too probably there wasn't another chance to go for the Grand Slam. The French is not always the easiest to win. I think Djokovic or anybody can tell you that. You know, Billie Jean, some people are better on the clay than others. And yeah, and you've got to have a year where health-wise everything is good. Physically everything's good. You're feeling good. You know, to do 4 in a row, that's not an easy thing to do. Just the pressure of it.
You talk about open tennis having come along. Yes, it came along. But when you hear people like Billie Jean and the Original Nine and Ann Jones talking now, they talk very much in terms of being in the vanguard of having made it happen. Maybe not open tennis in 68, because that came in for the whole of tennis, but certainly the birth of the women's tour from 1970 onwards. Did you feel part of that, or did you feel slightly apart from it?
I think probably my friends were mainly with the guys, and I had a husband by then. And I feel in those early years then, with the Newcombs and the Roaches and all those, I trained, I practiced, I went on Australian trips with them. We had mixed teams. I didn't really want it to all of a sudden go women all one way and men go the other way. And that was my heart. And I guess I was never very close. I was very close to Nancy Ritchie. We got on well. And I thought, here I am, we're going in two different directions. At that time, Jack Kramer had already approached me also. He was looking at having a women's thing. And I thought, well, you know, there's no Wimbledon, no Australia. And so at that time, you were in a battle. And then Billie Jean's going this way. You didn't know what was going to happen. It wasn't really got that strong until the Slims came in. The Philip Morris sort of thing all started to happen, that I could see how it was really going to work. I just didn't feel to break away with a group and start something, and they knew it wasn't going to work without having all the top players either. So there was this battle going on at that time. And it's all right to say, oh, well, we all didn't go that way, but a few went that way. But there was this whole manoeuvring going on with Jack Kramer, with Billy and her group, and then the Slims was coming in and they took on that whole lot. And that was when I came into it after that. And I think that's when Wimbledon started to find, hey, we're going to have to look at this whole thing.
I mean, it's obviously difficult in a sporting endeavour where you're all competing against each other to have a broad level of solidarity.
That's right.
But were you essentially with the other women players in wanting to develop a self-respecting women's tour, that there were just a few differences of opinion, or were there sort of...
Well, that didn't, I think, come in until it was established with the Slims. The money came in, there was a whole circuit set up, and then they knew that they needed the rest of the women also. And it was very interesting times. It was very confusing times within the sport. And I think probably I just sat on the ropes for a while to watch which way it was going to go. But when the slims came into it, you could see it all starting to work out.
I'm not trying to sow seeds of discord. I'm just interested in the fact that when one talks to Billie Jean and to Ann Jones, they, without being aggressive or attacking, sort of paint you as slightly as an outsider. And I just wonder how you felt in terms of...
I think you did. You felt, where do you fit in? Do you go with the establishment or do you go this way? And Jack Kramer was wanting this way.
And because they were very much against Jack at that stage.
I know.
They felt that he was trying to
defend... Well, because they had the men's and they then wanted the women's, you see. And so it was all happening. So we just sat there to see what was going to happen, how they were going to... Because you knew time they had to work it all out. Gladys Hellman had a lot to do with that, with the women's, with the slims, bringing it together. I don't think she ever got the glory of it, what she actually did. And Billy did a whole lot back then too, but back in that time, in that very, very early time, she did a whole lot.
And your relationship with Billy, obviously you have very different social views, but is there still a strong level of mutual respect?
We always had a respect for one another. I think with our views of all the other, I think, came in a little bit, and I think press created that, because we did always have great respect. We may not have been, you know, just, but we always, and I did, I have always honoured and respected her. I think, you know, she's a great player. We had some great matches, and everybody wanted a Court King final.
You're one of the very few people who has won a Grand Slam singles title as a mother. You retired two or three times, a couple of times to have your children, and yet you still came back and were at the top. Did you find it easy to come back, or was every time harder than the last?
I think after I had our first child, Daniel, I came back and probably played some of my best tennis. I think that one year I won 24 out of 25 tournaments and probably could have nearly had another Grand Slam if I had a thought about it. But I had a peak of fitness I never knew. And at that time they were doing some statistics, and there was a Russian athlete. They were doing some work with her, seeing why, and they were doing some work with me. And why women, when they came back off having children, there was just this... I felt as though I had a peak of fitness I had never experienced before. And it was easy. You know, I probably played some of my best tennis, and I always had to check myself to have a break, because I always thought I could go on and on.
Was this peak of fitness 1970 when you won the Slam, or did it come after that?
That came after that, and I thought, I don't know, I had just had this, felt so terrific as an athlete. It wasn't long, too long after that, I fell pregnant again, but I think I came back after the second one too early. And I had problems down in the calf muscles. And Yvonne Cawley, she did exactly the same after she had hers. You know, I think you thought you were a bit invincible and coming back too early. I don't think you'd let your body go back, just resettle a bit.
Your last Grand Slam singles titles were 73.
That's right. I think I came back in after the... a second one, and that was when I had the calf muscle problem. And I remember in America, we were on the, I think it was the slims, and I said to Barry, my heart's not in it. We could make a lot of money, but I said, I just don't want to play to that.
And what made you think your heart wasn't in it? Was there any one experience?
I didn't have a goal. I had to have a goal. I wanted to be the first Australian woman to win Wimbledon. That was my first. Then I wanted to win the Grand Slam. And then I wanted to be the first mum to be number one in the world again. I always had that. And then I looked and I said, I don't know, I don't think there's anything anymore. It's just, it's too hard.
Because you'd done it all, or because it was becoming tougher?
No, I think I'd done it all. I was getting to that age, I don't know, in you were 30, 34 or something, 35. I know Billy and then went on a lot longer.
She was a Wimbledon semi-finalist at 39, Williams, and the Williams sisters.
But I just felt, no, I wasn't, I didn't enjoy just to play. When I hung up my rackets, I coached for some years, young, good potential coming through just for the fun of it. But I never thought of getting out there or playing a match. I couldn't think of anything worse. It's interesting. Didn't mind having a hit and enjoy the exercise, but I didn't. That was it. Yeah.
So was it easy to call it a day?
I never went back into many of the slams.
And you didn't miss it?
No, I never. When I hung up the rackets, I didn't miss it. I'd play a game of squash or I'd get out and have a hit, but not the touring. I was never one to enjoy living out of a suitcase. I think I did that for so many years. I can travel to today and the ministry and things, but I don't look to that. I think I had so much of it in my tennis days, and that I'm a bit of a home person.
Because if you say to a youngster today, you know, one of the things you really need if you're going to make it on the tour is to be able to live out of a suitcase, not to be sure where you're going. And here are you with everything you've achieved, and you're saying, oh, yeah, I wasn't very good at that, didn't like it.
Well, I think I would have enjoyed it today because you had the money. You had to take your family with you. We had nobody. You know, when the money did come in and you could take your husband, because back in those days, the Roy Emersons and, you know, the ones that were married could never take their wives because they could never afford to. You know, it'd be even lonelier. But today it's easy. I think just everything. You can own your own plane just about. Travel where you want to, stay in the most magnificent places and eat the food you want and have your masseur and you can have your psychologist. It would have been wonderful.
There's one match I feel I ought to ask you about, and that was the match with Bobby Riggs. How did that come about, and what was your thinking in accepting the challenge?
It was probably one of my big mistakes in life, but I think at that time there was, you know, he was having a go at Billy, having a go at me, you know, though I had a lawyer friend back in that time, and my husband, and we're looking at it, and you know, here you are, number one. I think my big mistake was doing it right after Wimbledon. And you came out of the solidarity of Wimbledon and, you know, it's so quiet. I remember going and accepting to do it, and I didn't really believe that I could do it because I played with men and trained with men. But I remember going into it, and I think if I'd had a couple of seasons in team tennis, I would have understood it more. But I remember having the band there and people calling out foot fault, serve a double, you know, that was the razzmatazz. It was a shock. It was a shock. It was a very interesting. I thought, what am I doing out here? But I guess I got talked into it a little bit.
At what stage did you think, what am I doing out here?
Oh, when everybody was yelling out, because we come out of the serenity of
Wimbledon.
Of Wimbledon, yeah. And, you know, we not like today. It was very quiet, you know. I remember playing Billie Jean in that final, and you think, I wish there was a bit of noise or something, because it was so electrifying. You couldn't hear a pin drop. You could hear somebody cough, you know. Just a whole different razzmatazz, band, you know, yeah. It was different. It was a whole shock. In many ways, you were a bit embarrassed by it. And I do, I admit it, probably it was a mistake you made in your life.
So having accepted the challenge and it not working...
It did.
How did you view Billie Jean's match against him, which obviously is part of the folklore of history?
Well, I hope she'd beat him because I think by that time, there'd been team tennis around. You knew the noise, and she would have seen what had happened. And I think Billy, it's her nature a bit. She didn't mind that. I was completely different, yeah.
In 1979, you were inducted into the International Tennis Hall of Fame. What did that mean to you?
Well, you know, there are all those things are an honor. It doesn't matter where it is or what nation, whatever. And I think there wasn't all that many honors. So we had a lot of sporting awards and ABC, a lot of things like that here in the nation. But back then that was in the early years, and it was a great honor, you know, and I think players still enjoy being inducted into the Hall of Fame.
In 2003, Tennis Australia named what was until then Court One at Melbourne Park, the Margaret Court Arena. What did that mean to you?
That meant a lot to me, and I think particularly in your own nation too. And that's an honour. It's a beautiful court, and, you know, I think any of those things, anybody would really appreciate that and love that. And, you know, over the years I've had a lot of honours of different kinds awarded to me, and, you know, you always look at them as you're part of your life. Are you a role model for them? Are you thankful for them? It's part of the life that goes with it all. I think my coaches always taught me as a young person, you're always representing your nation. I think in my tennis, I always learned as a little girl that I represented my nation, because in the amateur days we did, there was no money. I remember the first Wimbledon I won was for my nation, it wasn't for me. And my coach always taught me that. He said, you ever throw your racket in the fence, I will never coach you again. So I had a lot of disciplines in those areas. You know, honour the umpire, respect your elders. I was taught all those things. And, you know, we never called anybody by their first name. It was always Mr. and Mrs., even our coaches.
Is that a matter of discipline, or is that a matter of just changing social customs?
Well, I think back then, you know, you had people that called people by their first name. I was taught those things, not to do that. So I think customs change, but some of those old traditional things I think are very valuable.
So if people ask you for advice now, whether it's a youngster who wants the benefit of your many years' experience or a parent who has a gifted child, what sort of advice are you comfortable giving?
I came from a background where there was alcohol and that. My mum never drank, my dad did. My mum went to church every Sunday. My mum had values, she had morals. She put those things into us. We were taught, hey, to get up and on a bus, give the elderly the seat, you know. We were taught those things, and I think a lot of those things are very valuable, and I think you have gifted children, you don't make them do it. They want to do it because they love to do it. I love sport, I love playing tennis. I was never told or made I had to do it. And I think you see so many children today that are gifted, and I always say, you go with your heart. Not if you're going, your people want you to study law and you want to be a doctor or you want to be, you go where you want your heart, because that's the thing that you will do in life that you will love most.
So when you see today's tennis, you know, it's very different to the tennis that you played. The equipment's different.
I think the equipment's beautiful.
So you enjoy today's tennis?
The equipment, because we pioneered it. How I ever won the Grand Slam with the Camel racket, I don't know. It was an aluminium, and they were experimenting with it. Nobody knew how to string it. The strings would break, and your Wimbledon, and you had nobody who knew how to do it, so you had to take enough, but they would break so frequently, and the rivets in them, and then they'd crack. You know, they're not around today, but it was an aluminium racket, and Rod Laver and I had contracts. The head was like a little squash racket, and Rod Laver, he didn't like it at all, and I loved it, because I just the touch I could get with it. I remember Rod getting one of the Dunlop wooden rackets, getting them painted gold and using it. They let him do that because he had this contract, and he couldn't play with it. We were part of that pioneering side of those things. But the rackets today, I think, are beautiful. I mean, I was playing up until hitting still until about 5 years ago, and using metal rackets, and the power and the touch you get from him is beautiful.
Using the modern day rackets?
Yes, yeah. I think we would have enjoyed playing with them.
And when you watch today's tennis, do you look at today's generation of players and see them as successes to you, or do you worry about certain trends in tennis? Is there anything you would wish that were different in today's tennis?
I think the only thing, if I look at the women's tennis today, is I'd love to see more volley and the use of the whole court more. I think if you get two players just hitting up and down the court all the time, I think it can be a little bit boring. I think some of the men's matches are very, very exciting in the time. There's an evenness, some great matches. I find in the women, I feel at the moment, just the variety, the artistry of the game, I think, has been lost a little bit.
And do you see anybody in today's tennis who you think, yes, that is my equivalent? She plays like I did, based on today's tennis.
No, not quite. I think there's a potential there with Coco, but if you don't learn to volley when you're little, when you're 8 or 9, like I did, you'll always fear the net a bit. I think some try to bring it in later down the line. That's hard to do. It's got to be a natural thing to you. It's just an instinct thing, just a knowing and a seeing and an aggression, you know, and I think they don't know what they're missing out on.
I mean, Coco has some of the best volleys in women's tennis. She's comfortable. She's played a lot of doubles.
Well, I think that's why they should keep playing doubles. I think instead of practicing every other day for an hour or two, keep playing those matches. You see, like, even Storm Hunter, I think the little Aussie that's just come through and realizing she can play singles, she's played doubles. But you keep doing it. Yeah, you know, I think they think, oh, I'm going to be too tired for my next match. But yet you'll go and practice for 2 hours. You might as well use it in a match, yeah.
So you'd recommend to youngsters from the early stages to learn to volley?
Oh, and I think it'd be from the early days just not to play singles, but play doubles.
That's interesting, because that's sort of slightly counter the current wisdom.
Well, I think it helps their game so much. And, you know, I loved playing mixed doubles.
You did the Grand Slam in 62 in mixed.
Yeah, and I loved playing mixed doubles more than I did ladies' doubles. And, you know, it's just the power, the having to work with the man, having to go in and to volley, and it just makes you a lot more aggressive, yeah.
And are you optimistic about the future of tennis?
Oh, I think tennis is looking in good shape. You know, I'd love every child to play tennis because it's good for their life, the disciplines, the focus, having to, you know, just work with others, and particularly in teams and doubles. And I think sport's great for our young people, and I encourage it very, very much.
Margaret Court, thank you very much for sharing your life's experience in tennis with us.
Thanks, Chris. Appreciate it.
A fascinating interview with a complex character, and perhaps one that tells more stories between the lines than some of the other legends we featured on the Tennisworthy podcast. And perhaps there's a lesson in there for all of us about the way Margaret Court and Billie Jean King can be genuinely respectful of each other as tennis greats, even if they do disagree quite fundamentally on certain social issues. Please let your friends and associates know about these interviews with tennis legends, as the more people who listen to them, the more of them we can do. You've been listening to the Tennisworthy podcast, which is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame in association with the Tennis Radio Network. I'm Chris Bowers. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to your company next time.